Well, good morning.
Good morning to you.
So I was thinking about truth and meaning as I was sitting at my desk, and then I glanced at my bookshelves, and I noticed I must have about 4,000 pages on truth and meaning in my books. And I thought, well, we might need more than 1 week to deal with these two topics, truth and meaning. And then I start to ponder how much truth and beliefs have been conversation and problems for Unitarian Universalists to have the sense that we can really believe anything we want, or we struggle for our own beliefs. And so in that, I started wrestling with, well, what is an absolute belief? What could we all agree upon that would be an absolute truth? And after about 10 minutes, I said, well, everything organic moves. Everything organic grows. Grass, trees, me. And then I told Helen my great discovery. She said, wait a minute, what about coal? That's a carbon, and all life forms are carbon, and if coal's carbon, that's... Are there any absolute truths? I don't know. But that's a pretty close one, I think. And if that's true, that means truth has a relationship to motion. Truth has a relationship to movement. Truth is not static. Truth does not sit still. I can remember in my training, John Patton, who was a tough guy. If you ever think about doing PhD or doctoral work, and there's one guy on the committee, you like him, but you look at him and you go, what'd I do wrong? That kind of fellow. Well, that's who he was. He was tough, and he shared one thing with me, and I realized he did not like his students to be depressed. So we got to talking about that, and he said, that's because there's no movement. And by the time you get into this course of ministry and into this course of pastoral counseling, we need movement. Truth is not static. Truth is layered. And what I mean by truth being layered. How are you today? Well, I'm fine. In my head. Well, I don't know. I'm just about to lose my job. And, well, I don't know. About every 2 years I lose my job. I wonder what that means about me. You know, I've been doing this pattern since I was 10 years old. And now I've got a memory of my mother and father fighting over me as they go through a divorce, and then now I've got images of me, my brothers and my sisters fighting while I'm watching this fighting over here, and now I'm looking at my life and I see this feeling in me of being rejected and abandoning all my life, but I'm fine. Truth is layered. I'm riding through a poorer part of town, African-American community, living in a ghetto with my father, and I say, well, Dad, why are all these black people living in a poor community? And he says, well, that's the way they are, son. That's just the way it is. Well, in 1890, I talked a bit about this last week, I think, in sundown towns. What happened in 1890, the industry of this country got to the place where the people of the country could no longer buy any more than they were producing. They found their balance. And when they found their balance, they began to look out of this country. Rather than saying, out of our wealth, how can we turn back into our country and use this wealth to benefit the people of this country? Rather than that, they took their money and they began an imperialistic plunge over in the Philippines and that. At that particular time, there became an issue with color, non-white, Philippines, and how can we be oppressive to them and but be equal to people of color here? So that began to be an oppressive process. Prior to that, in 1867, many blacks went to the north, Minnesota, Wisconsin, were integrated into the communities, had families into the communities, and I'm reading this one guy, and he said it was the highlight of race relations in our country. So 1867 to 1890, these people had children now. And by 1920, their children were having children. So for some, where they were when their fathers and mothers were post office people, carpenters, all kinds of jobs, so they were established. Then came something happened. These people were literally run out of their towns. White superiority began to take over. If this is 100% of the different jobs African American people could hold, within 4 years, it was 50% less. And during the Depression, it went even less. So these black folk free were herded into communities. Truth is layered. And that's the layering of truth. And so we search for truth as Unitarian Universalists. Truth is not static. There's always something we need to be doing about truth about ourselves and truth about others. And one thing, too, that we need to know about truth. If truth is going to be moving, and if truth is going to be alive, and if truth is going to have motion, I think we need to understand what does experience mean, because if we can understand what experience means, we can get a hold of the movement of truth, because it is our experiences that come together, that are structured within us, that lead us to the conclusion about what is truth. John Dewey, in a book, What is Education, has this to say about experience. Blind and capricious impulses hurry us heedlessly from one thing to another. So far as this happens, everything is writ in water. There is none of that cumulative growth which makes an experience anything in any vital sense of the term. On the other hand, many things happen to us in the way of pleasure and pain which do not connect with any prior activity of our own. These are mere accidents. So far as we are concerned, there is no before, there is no after to such experiences, there is no retrospect, there is no outlook, and consequently, no meaning. We get nothing which may be carried over to foresee what is likely to happen next. We gain an ability to adjust ourselves to what is to happen, what is coming. No added control. Only by courtesy can such an experience be called an experience. To learn from experience is to make a backward and a forward connection between what we do to things and what we enjoy or suffer from things and consequence. When something happens to us, John Dewey is saying, that's not the experience. The experience is complete of when we look back and when we look forward and we come to some understanding what that experience means to us. And as a therapist, I got to thinking about that, because one thing I deal with myself and with others in the counseling office is we are stuck in experiences. There are moments and times in our lives, maybe not everybody in this room, but in a lot of people's lives, in which we are frozen, in which we are stuck. There are experiences in our lives which we do not look backward, and we do not look forward, and we do not make meaning of those experiences. They're just there. And as a therapist, the experiences that I run into like that are mostly hurtful experiences, trauma, abandonment, rejection, those kind of things, or a slow shaming through time, something like that, a number of things. If that happens, there is no movement. If there is no movement in my memory, because that's organic, whatever happens to me in me is organic. If there is no movement, I'm incongruent with the truth that everything organic grows. I'm incongruent with the movement of the earth. Now, I'm not separate from the earth. I'm part of this process. And if there's something in me that's froze and it's incongruent with the nature and the movement of things, that's a problem. That's a problem. It blocks the experience from continuing on. It blocks us from growth, blocks us from intimacy, moves us to self-destructive behaviors, any number of things. So when we begin to look at our story, Is it possible to move through our story with some kind of fluid movement, or when I think about my story, I think about particular times and don't think about other times? And that's a question you can ask yourselves. Are there experiences in me that have not yet been felt, that have not yet been pondered about, that have not yet been thought about what that might mean for my future? Like the layered experiences, I said to that person, every 2 years they lose their job. Actually, I run into that a lot, especially when I was working at the house for homeless men, alcoholic men, and it was phenomenal. A lot of them, every 2 years, they'd lose their job. So some kind of two-year cycle. There's something stuck there. There's no movement there. It becomes self-destructive. And that way, people are not making meaning of their life. They're just going through life without making meaning, without being anchored, without that depth. How many of you have you experienced a relationship where a person who doesn't share their feelings, doesn't share their stories, but wants to have an intimate relationship? It doesn't work. You have to know the other person to be close. Two narrative therapists, Epstein and White, they have this to say about what we do with our experiences, what happens to them. In striving to make sense of life, persons face the task of arranging their experiences of events and sequences across time in such a way as to arrive to a coherent account of themselves and the world around him. Specific experiences or events of the past, present, and those that are predicted to occur in our future must be connected in their linear sequence to develop this account. This account can be referred to as a story or self-narrative. The success of this storying of experience provides persons with a sense of continuity and meaning in their lives, and this is relied upon for the ordering of our daily lives and for the interpretation of further experiences. Somehow, when this experience occurs, well, first, the linear sequence part, I think it has to be in some kind of order, but it might be circular. It might not actually all be linear. But that's for another time. Okay. Somehow, our imagination orders our experience, organizes our experience, puts it into a particular way of existence that helps me or doesn't help me interpret the events of the here and now. Our minds order our stories. I like to say periodically, either our imagination has its way with us, or I have my way with my imagination. If I'm not in a reflective meaning-making process as part of my spiritual growth, my history will drive my life and I won't even have a thought about it. And as I've said before in here, there comes a time when we need to step out of the river of our history. And we need to look at the river of our history. And we need to figure out, is that a river I want to be in? Or is that a river I'd rather be out of? Or is that a river I need to clean up? What is the river I'm floating in? So I think that's kind of a curious concept, that our mind orders our stories. I haven't really thought about it. I've got a history. What do you mean there's a particular organizing to that? My life just seems to kind of happen, and it's happened pretty good. So is there a way we can grab a hold and we can actually, with intentionality, change the way our story is within us? We could change the way our story is so that we can enjoy life more. We can change the way our story is in us so that we don't have any more negative self-judgments, negative judgments on ourselves when different things occur, when we don't actually heap upon ourselves shame and guilt. Is there such a way that I can organize my story that at the bottom of my story, the core of who I am as a human being, I have a sense of love and compassion? Is that possible? Thich Nhat Hanh, a Buddhist monk, gives us an example of how he has learned to order his story. And what he has learned to do in ordering his story, he has learned to strengthen the foundation of his inner world, so that will become the determinative of how the rest of his story is going to be structured and going to be lived out. And I thought I would share with that. He gives us two exercises that we can do. There are three prostrations we can see in his particular structure and the organizing of the story that he has and that comes out of experience. The first one, he deals with his family of origin. He talks about the ancestors of his family. He talks about reflecting upon his mother. He talks about reflecting upon his father. He talks about reflecting upon grandmother, grandfather, and the ancestors in his lineage. He talks about reflecting about them and moving in that reflection to a place of love so that love moves through time and back to him and consequently into the future. That's one way he begins to structure his time. The next thing that he does in that particular thing is he puts his spiritual ancestors. So he goes from family of origin to spiritual ancestors, and I've got to thinking about that. Here's this man that meditates on his spiritual ancestors, and somehow that contributes at the core of who he is as a human being, the sense of compassion, the sense of love. I got to thinking about, well, who are my spiritual ancestors? Who are the spiritual people in my life? And I started thinking about it, and my friend Charlie Hendricks, who I wrestled with and played football with in high school, his father was the preacher. Even though it was a fundamentalist church, what he preached was a sense of love and sense of care, and I thought, that's a spiritual ancestor. He's there. Mr. and Mrs. Spiegel, who kind of had an off-youth group but really wasn't accepted well in our church, but since they had seven kids, they were always kind of involved in our youth group because they made up a big part of the youth group, and so we'd periodically go over to their house. Now, this church over here, where I was, they believed in hell. They were kind of sturdy and strong on hell, but then looking back, I know why Mr. and Mrs. Spiegel were not really full-fledged into that church. Because one time we were having this Bible study in their church, separated from that church. Sometimes ministers have an issue with that, especially if the theology is different in this off group. And so the hell came up, and Mr. Spiegel looked at me and he says, wait a minute, flipped the Bible and said, it says, all people will see heaven. Jesus came to save all people. And we were people of the book, so I had to believe the book. So now I got a problem. Because now everybody gets to heaven. And I like that myself. And so I didn't know that he was a spiritual ancestor that put a seed in me of universalism. That's where that came from. Probably came from the love of my mother and father and found agreement within me, which means that spiritual ancestor is congruent. And then the youth minister, Bob Shine. And then when I moved somewhere else, James Latimer, another pastor. Then when I went to seminary, there were teachers and professors. And then I got into the clinical work. And the clinical work really had a lot of spiritual people to help open my doors and help me deal with my family of origin issues in such a way I could begin to love myself. And I never thought about it before, but these are my spiritual ancestors. And when I started lining these people up in my mind, and I started just to think about them and just to think about what they gave to me, and the light that they gave to me started to come out of the rest of my story. And it was powerful. It was strong. Those people had life and they were living. And then I began to understand that our history is a living history. And the truth of our history is told and retold and can be transformed and can change. We have a living history, and we say it when we read traditions. Our tradition is a living tradition. Thich Nhat Hanh is telling us there's this meditative method where we bring our spiritual ancestors out, and we are grateful for what they have taught to us. And that gives us an inner strength that contributes to the transformation of the core of who we are so that we can love ourselves. That's what he's doing. He's teaching us how to organize our inner stories. And then he says the number three, that we begin to move out, and it's the love of all nature and energy. Then there's this another thing that he does, and he moves further out. He talks about, he goes from family of origin, he goes to spiritual ancestors, then he goes talks about all living beings, and he goes to talk about everything in the earth, and he includes the animals, he includes the bugs, he includes the trees, he includes everything. But what he does is he moves from a sense of love, from a sense of love, from a sense of love. He encounters every next meditation with the foundation of love. So he doesn't move to automatically all of nature and all of the universe and all of the bugs and all of the grass. He doesn't go there first. He takes care of his spiritual ancestors and he takes care of his family of origin first. So that when I go out and I encounter society and I start meditating on society and I start meditating on the things that maybe our culture does, I don't come to that meditation with anger. I don't come to that meditation with judgment. I come to that meditation with some sense of spiritual maturity at this point, that my sense of spiritual maturity and love and compassion can move through of how these things are in my imagination. Now, how many of us today can go to particular things in our imagination, what's happening in this world, and our first thing is an emotional reactivity? I can't believe it. I'm angry. This is the end. We're in trouble. The Unitarians are good at that because we look for the injustices. We want to do something about the injustices. We want to be active about the injustices. Thich Nhat Hanh is teaching us not, I believe, not to do that unless you've got a foundation where in your imagination your feeling and your understanding of your family of origin, your feeling and your understanding of your spiritual ancestors is a foundation of love and compassion. If you do this before you do that, I'm going to be caught raging at what I see a creeping oppression in this country and I'm going to get trapped. I'm going to get hooked. I might even create injustices to deal with this injustice. I'll get so angry. He's teaching us that our spiritual, to work with our spiritual selves, there must be motion within ourselves. There must be movement within ourselves. We must look at the experiences of our life, reflect on our history, what would that mean for our future, and come back in, what does that mean for me now? And then when I can do that with love and compassion, then I can begin to understand how to deal with the injustices in the world and meet those injustices with a sense of love. Now, I'll tell you, I'm not there. I mean, that's a hard one to get to for me. If that's a difficult one to get to for me, does that mean somewhere back here I'm not working with my spiritual ancestors so that my encounter and my experience with my spiritual ancestors is too weak to help me love everybody in my family of origin? That my discipline is to experience the love of my spiritual ancestors. And then he moves to my spiritual tradition. He talks about Jesus, he talks about Moses, he talks about Buddha. Can I organize my mind to access the love of this spiritual tradition, bring that into me, and then deal with my family of origin? Then bring that love to bear upon my family of origin, to bear upon those people who have betrayed me, those people who have hurt me. Because if I go there first, I can tell you from experience, it's not love and compassion. It's the first thing that comes out of me. Bitterness, anger, victim, whatever it might be. But he's teaching us there is a way to structure our stories in our mind, that we move back to our spiritual ancestors, our spiritual tradition, our families, our communities, and we bring those out that loved us. And we allow that love to move through us. And then when that happens, and when we engage this world, then we can move to the love of this world. Then we can move to the love of the grass, the love of the trees. And God knows, when we look at our country, there's not a lot of love of earth we can find sometimes. There's a lot of destruction of the earth. Then, when we can find that love of our spiritual ancestors, and we can find that love of our family of origin, and that's strong, and we can encounter the injustices with a sense of love and compassion, then all of a sudden there's something that happens, is that we move out of ourselves and we become part of the history, that river of history that we talked about a couple weeks ago. We become part of a moving and living tradition that is moving through time that is bigger than us. And then we can draw strength from there. That we are in a river of life, a river of time, and a spiritual tradition where love and compassion has been moving for thousands of years, and it will continue to move for thousands of years, and I am part of that river. It is bigger than my family origin. It is bigger than the spiritual ancestors that have occurred in my life, my supervisors, my teachers, my ministers, my youth ministers, the universalists that snuck in. It's bigger. Our spiritual work is to recognize spirituality is about moving inward and reflecting upon our lives to see how it's ordered. Thich Nhat Hanh is teaching us to do that. And I'm suggesting we can do that. We can do that. And we need to do that. Because as we are doing that, struggling with that, or just enjoying it, whatever that may be, in the next week, we are going to put on the web page some stories about our present day culture. Some things, I know the title of the story was "The Army Turns Green," the sermon. But the Army has decided that the environmentalists were right all along, and if we don't get on board with the environmentalists, we're going to be in big trouble. The Army is implying that there's an urgency. Now, the reason I'm doing this, because it may seem kind of pushed, but what I want us to do as a community is I want us to take an experience of reading some information, some interpretations about our culture. That is the experience. Wrestle with that experience. Reflect individually of our history and what that experience means in our history. Look into the future and see what that experience might mean for our future. Interpret that experience, because the interpretation at that point is the foundation of how we're going to make meaning of that experience, and the foundation of where we're going to put that experience in our narrative. Because once you experience it, you've got to do something with it. You can get stuck in the experience. You can keep that experience of being alive, keep it open, keep it up. You can interpret it, and when you interpret it, you begin to put it in your story, in a narrative, in a particular way, and then we make meaning of it. So this is an invitation to have experience, to put it in our stories, and to make meaning of it as a community. And I'm saying that truth always has movement. I'm suggesting that. So when I am working with something and I determine it's the truth, it will be congruent with movement. Something within us. And I'll just briefly read a couple sentences to give you some idea where I'm coming from. This is a statement, September 2005, from the joint forces of our country. The current world energy situation poses a national threat unparalleled in 225 years. These are the armed forces. The economy, particularly the transportation component, has become heavily dependent upon foreign oil. Concurrent with the rising demand are indications that the world production may soon peak, followed by a permanent decline in storage. Moreover, most of the remaining oil is concentrated in distant political hostile locations, inviting interdiction by enemies. And this is from Energy Trends and Their Implications for the U.S. Army Installations. So it's not Greenpeace. The days of inexpensive, convenient, abundant energy sources are quickly drawing to a close. According to a recently released U.S. Army strategic report, the report points to peak and global oil production looks to be eminent, with a wide-reaching implications for the U.S. Army and society in general. To sustain its mission, the Army, and ensure its capability to protect and support the forces, the Army must insulate itself from the economic and logistical energy-related problems coming in the near and mid-future. Insulate, as we read on, from us. That's what it's saying. This requires a transition to modern, secure, and efficient energy systems, to a building technologies that are safe, environmentally friendly. The Army's finally turning green. These supply and demand side challenges require thoughtful planning execution using integrated solutions. In the near future, it's pretty close. Okay. And when they say long term, the adequacy of supply of electrical resources in the long term between 2009 and 2013, that's their definition of long term, is increasingly uncertain in the United States and Canada. Then they go on to say, we're going to do this, what all of us should be doing, no matter what the government does with the citizens. We're going to take care of ourselves. The government and the citizens, we can no longer depend upon the government to tell the Army to take care of itself, so we're taking matters into our own hands. Now, the government and the citizens, they're going to have to do what they're going to do. But the Army's saying, we're going to do this. And I'm going, wow, what the world does that mean? Well, and then what does that mean for me as a minister? Quite possibly sounding like a nutcase. What does that mean as a minister? And do I feel any responsibility to this community? Yes, I do. So I figure, what is the best way to handle this? Because I know we can debate. What is the best, and this is maybe time for movement and not debate. What is the best way to do this? The best way to do this, I can figure, is to look at a healthy process of experiencing something. What do we do with that experience? What does it mean to make meaning? What does it mean to search for truth and find meaning? What does that mean? How do we do that? And so this is the formula, I guess you could say, the method I was talking about earlier, is the healthiest way I can find to search for truth and make meaning. This information caused an experience with me. And when I look back after Jimmy Carter, by the way, when Jimmy Carter said we should do something different with energy, Brazil did. Brazil's independent from oil, same year as Carter said we should do something different. They were a military government. We were a democracy. I mean, it's crazy. So if there is a responsibility to one another as a community, if I have a responsibility as a minister, then I got to say something. I think this is the healthiest process that we can come up with a community to see that if we want to respond as a community or not. So it's an invitation to enter into an internal spiritual contemplation, pondering of what this information might mean for you individually, history, future, what it might mean for you as you interpret that. How are you going to put that experience in your story? How are you going to make meaning of it? And then what are we going to do? Let's do that. And this information will be on the web page in the next week, and there'll be a pamphlet of it in the back next week.
Just a really quick question. Is there any particular book or film you have that you would recommend?
Say again?
Is there any special book or film you have that you would recommend?
This one I'm using now, I've got in the office, it's just Love, and there are many, but I love that book.
Yeah, that's
good. It's a very nice book. Because I know I need to be doing that meditation as I'm dealing with this information. Because this information gets me emotionally reactive.
So we'll come back in 2 weeks and discuss it at length. And before we... close our service, we're going to take up our social action offerings for the month as we stand and sing hymn number 140.